At the Commonwealth Policy Foundation, we try to approach the issues of life, marriage, religious liberty, and fiscal integrity from a biblical perspective that promotes thoughtfulness and kindness. We work with political leaders and concerned citizens from all across the state. To stay informed, visit commonwealthmatters.org and sign up for our e-newsletter. The Commonwealth Policy Foundation is a nonprofit organization that only exists because of friends like you. Thanks for tuning in to The Commonwealth Matters.
Welcome to The Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson, Executive Director of the Commonwealth Policy Center. Critical race theory. It's one of the most controversial topics today. It is in schools across the country, and it is in Kentucky schools as well. Joining me on the program is Justin Werner, our Louisville guy, recently joined Commonwealth Policy Center over the summer, and we are glad to have him here to further unpack what critical race theory is. Justin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Richard.
Justin, you're a student at Southern Seminary. We got connected through a mutual friend who teaches at Southern, and you are the critical race theory guy. And I just kind of throw that out there because we put this task on you earlier this year, right after you joined us, because this is, number one, it's an important issue. Number two, it's something that you're concerned about as well. Let's just start out with, what is critical race theory? A lot of listeners may have heard the term. It's kind of thrown about. It has different meanings to different people, I think.
No.
So give us a solid definition of critical race theory.
So I think the best concise definition of critical race theory that I can give is that it is the worldview that sees our country as being founded in racism that benefits white people and oppresses minorities, and it seeks to bring about political change. And I think to unpack that a little bit, I just want to point out some important things in that. So first, the fact that it's a worldview. A lot of people will say it's like a methodology or an analytical tool or something. So the theory aspect of critical race theory, by theory, they don't mean like theory, like Einstein's theory of relativity or something like that. What they're referring to is a postmodern worldview. So whenever you think postmodern, think like they deny objective truth. So automatically embedded in it is a worldview. It's not just an analytical tool. And then also that it seeks to bring about revolutionary political change. Now this gets to the critical and critical race theory. So critical is not referring to like what we would think like critical thinking, like you think deeply about it. Critical means basically pointing out and exposing what they believe are problems in society so that you can bring about political change to those things. Not reform, but to tear it down and build something better.
Justin, I'll jump in and say the first time I heard the term critical theory is when I actually started out in law school about 27 years ago, actually. And that was a school of thought brought into the legal realm. Critical theory has been around longer than that, but it was fairly, it was just emerging. It was becoming more widely known, and it was taught in some of the law schools. But critical theory, the critical legal studies actually was that area. But the idea of critical theory applies to other areas like the area of race as well, doesn't it?
Yeah.
How long has critical race theory been around?
Critical race theory has been around, it's been, I believe it was officially in the 70s when the founders, Richard Delgado, Alan Freeman, and Derrick Bell got together to kind of officially say what critical race theory is. So it's been kind of just been around and evolving since then.
So it's been around for 40 years, but why are we just really hearing about it now since George Floyd and really since the Black Lives Matter movement? Mm-hmm. Why are we just hearing about it now?
I think it's kind of just coming to the forefront now as being called critical race theory. I think just it's influenced the way that we think about race issues and everything. So I think when you hear people say that we live in a white supremacist like country, everything like that, or that where people talk about systemic racism, like our institutions are systemically racist, all of this is critical race theory language. So I think now we're just hearing kind of just we're seeing behind the scenes the ideology that's influenced this language.
For those who are not watching this, but just listening, I need to point out that Justin is a person of color. So he's coming at this from a perspective that we don't see many people of color analyzing critical race theory carefully and then critiquing it as well. Mm-hmm. So why, how did you become a critic of critical race theory? Because you grew up, yeah. Tell us a little bit about your background and tell us how you got involved with this issue.
So I grew up in, born and raised in New Jersey. So I'm a Northerner. I apologize to my Kentuckians, but born and raised in New Jersey. I grew up in kind of a more ghetto area for most of my life. I grew up single parent household. My biological father, I don't really know him. He's a drug dealer. Has about 30 kids from about 20 something different women, everything like that. So I grew up in kind of a bad neighborhood. Things got a little bit better when I was a teenager and we moved into kind of a better development. So that's a little just short on my upbringing. How I kind of got woken up to this, just like wanting to study critical race theory and just learning about this was really with the George Floyd incident and just seeing the rise of just like people saying about like police brutality and police shootings, saying that they are all racist. Where the George Floyd incident was horrible, but then I was looking in light of other incidences like Mike Brown, which was seen that there's no evidence of racism with that. So that's kind of what piqued my interest. And I was like, well, let me just start diving into this and learning more.
Thank you for sharing that. And your perspective is really valuable. I find that your voice maybe is taken more seriously because of your background and because you're Black. And we appreciate you sharing your perspective and joining the CPC team as well to help us think carefully about this issue. You mentioned Mike Brown. I want to just touch on that briefly.
Yeah.
That was the alleged police brutality, unjust shooting of a Black man who alleged to have his hands up and yet the police shot him. Remember, hands up, don't shoot?
Yep.
Tell us just briefly about that. We had a conversation the other day about that because the media, mainstream media, did a terrible job reporting on that, didn't
Completely.
They?
Completely. Yeah, so it came out that basically Mike Brown was just doing nothing. Then the whole hands up, don't shoot happened, and then Officer Darrell Wilson just unloaded on him.
Yeah.
Then it was investigated by, by the Department of Justice. The Attorney General was Eric Holder, who's Black. It was under Obama's administration, so Black president. And then it was found out that what actually happened is Mike Brown had just like strong arm robbed a convenience store. There's a video of him literally just ramming the owner of the store into a wall. So Darrell Wilson stops him. Mike Brown assaults Darrell Wilson, tries to go for his gun.
Is that a police officer?
Officer, okay. Officer Darrell Wilson.
Yeah.
He assaulted him, tried to go for his gun. Eventually, in the altercation, Officer Wilson shoots him twice and he still gives him warning, tells him to get on the ground, to stop. And then eventually Mike Brown charges after Darrell Wilson and he eventually, unfortunately, unloads on him and Mike Brown dies.
Sad situation, yet it was wrongly reported by the media.
Yep.
And that led to rioting. It led to destruction of property. And it was a war zone in Ferguson, Missouri for quite a while.
Yeah.
This is a story about what bad reporting can lead to. And what misinformation can lead to as well. And that's why we're here. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson with Justin Warner, and we are talking about critical race theory. Justin, one of the things that I've heard alleged is that there are some things that we can learn from critical race theory or even use. Some have said, use the analogy, like, eat the fish, but spit out the bones, right? Is there any truth to that? Is there some good in it?
What critical race theory gets right, we don't actually learn from critical race theory. I think that's what's important to realize. So, like, the fact that racism happens, we don't learn that from critical race theory. And ultimately, what they refer to as racism, most of the time, we wouldn't actually say is racist. I think the biggest thing is just what they get right. We don't actually learn from them. And then they take things that are true. So another big example is always history, which I think to understand the way they view history, I have to back up a little bit to the way that they understand people. So they are collectivist, meaning that they don't see us as individuals. They see us as representatives of our collective racial groups. So we're having a conversation. I'm a representative of the Black community. You're a representative of the white community. And now we're interacting with each other. So as soon as you say that, all of our histories are attached to each other. So for you, racism is immediately attached to you. In the history of our country, like with Jim Crow, slavery is all attached to you. And for me, I'm seen as this perpetual victim. So in our interactions, those always happen. So then when you take the way that they read situations and use history, that's always present. So Robin DiAngelo, who's a prominent critical race theorist, in her book, Why Fragility, she basically goes and gives diversity lectures. It's the whole diversity, equity, inclusion. She basically goes, gives lectures and tells white people the different ways they're racist. But in her book, she talks about an interaction, and there is this woman, Joan, who's a white woman, that numerous times in the interaction, she interrupted a black woman, which we would look at that and say, okay, well, that might be a little rude for her to interrupt her. But DiAngelo points out and said this to Joan, that it's actually racist because white people have a history of silencing black people and like quieting their voice. So no longer is it just this person's being rude. It's embedded in that is just another example of this historical reality.
So on one hand, I want to talk about historical realities because in my old, at my old farm in Western Kentucky, I lived in a black section of Trigg County. And one of the one of my neighbors worked on my vehicle, and there other locals would hang out there while John Lindsay was working on cars. Some of the locals would hang out. Remember one of the guys telling me the story of what it was like in Jim Crow Western Kentucky when he would travel through Madisonville. There was a police officer who would pull over black people, and he would essentially extort money from them. And he told a story of when he went through, he was going to visit family in Evansville and traveled through Madisonville, and the officer pulled him over, as usual, and asked for money, and my friend Roy McGee, who was black, didn't have any money, and he spent the night in jail. And that is, that was part of the Jim Crow South, and that was part of racism that was embedded in the law enforcement at that time. And Roy didn't have any anger over it. He wasn't a bitter person. He rose above that. Ended up, he was a farmer, raised a large family. But the reason I bring this up is because that is part of his history. Now, I think the question is, or the demarcation line, the dividing point here is, what do you do with that? Like, if you're going to hold that as a grievance your whole life, you're going to have a chip on your shoulder and look at all law enforcement as being corrupt or people to avoid. But if you realize, if you look at it from another angle, and here's the angle I want to go in, as believers, as followers of Jesus, first of all, there's a different identity that we have. It's not our skin color. You and I are more closely related because we're both followers of Jesus. That's our main identity, and that transcends skin color. For those who've been wronged, like Roy McGee, you can process what happened to him through this lens of grievance and through this lens of systemic racism, which was in place there. Or you can move ahead. If he was a Christian, he could move on past that and realize that Christ would is the ultimate reconciler. He's the ultimate one who brings justice. Or you can just develop a mentality of bitterness. And I by the way, saw that. I was at an airport just a few days ago, and I saw somebody who had real grievance that was lashing out at a white person and made some blanket statements of racism actually towards them, and I was part of the conversation. But I hate that. I hate to see people who've been wounded. I also hate to see grievances that are nurtured and this mentality of it's all, everybody's racist and they're out to get me. How can, you know, I know I just shared a lot there, Justin, but how would you recommend dealing somebody who has experienced racism?
I think definitely the first thing is having to be reminded as believers that we're called to forgive and love our enemies. So I think whenever somebody has wronged us, first and foremost, like, we're called to forgive them. We're not called to forgive them once they've made things right and they've apologized to us. We're called to forgive them immediately. Jesus goes as far as say, if you don't forgive, my Father in heaven won't forgive you. So I think with that, and then I think as well, I think there has to be a deeper desire than wanting to be, I guess, like, instead of wanting retribution, because I think a big thing that we see like with this ideology is that it's kind of just like, if somebody's a racist, they need to basically be destroyed. Mm-hmm. Or if I'm a victim of racism, the racist person needs to be destroyed. Mm-hmm. But I think as Christians, our deepest desire needs to be that they come to know who Christ is. So I think that even if enduring wrong from somebody so that I may like show, like return their unkindness with love, and ultimately that be the means God uses to bring them to Christ, like, glory be to God, and I ought to hope for that. I shouldn't, like, I think people's deepest problem is not I guess in a sense, like, not be racist. It's that their deepest need is to come and know who Christ is. And I think that has to, and then I think also, like, when it comes to those of us that, like, deal with racists, like, I mean, I've dealt with racist police officers. I had the most deepest problem of race, I guess, like, the traumatic experience of racism was with one of my younger brothers. He made the mistake of dating a white girl, and her father hit him with a wiffle ball bat, pulled a shotgun at him, and eventually jumped him with his friends. Mm. So there's some serious racism right there, like racist incidents.
Yeah.
But I pray that man comes to know who Christ is, and I am thankful that as Christians we can also look forward that we have a day where the Father will wipe away all of our tears, that this world isn't it, that we have a hope in heaven. So even if we continue to experience racism and everything, we can love our enemies, pray that they come to know Christ, and then look forward to the day where racism will be completely eradicated by God.
That's a good word. We're at a hard stop right now. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back in a minute, and we will resume this conversation on critical race theory.
Hi, Richard Nelson here with the Commonwealth Policy Center. It's clear that the news media isn't always fair. In fact, there's lots of far-left bias and political gamesmanship. No surprise there. So if you're looking for a perspective that's grounded in the truth of Scripture and our nation's founding principles, then get plugged into CPC's resources. Sign up for our e-newsletter at CommonwealthPolicyCenter.org. You can also follow us on Facebook at Commonwealth Policy Center. And we're on Twitter at CPC4Kentucky.
Welcome back to the Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson, Executive Director of the Commonwealth Policy Center, here with Justin Warriner, and we are talking critical race theory. Justin, I have heard it said that critical race theory is just one way to look at history, and that's why it's being taught in our schools. It is being taught in Kentucky schools. I was just on the phone the other day with a pastor who has children in Owensboro Public Schools, and their middle school student child came home with an assignment that had critical race theory in it, that actually painted the white race as aggressors and oppressors, and had some of the stuff that we're talking about here in this program. Mm. So how do you address that it's just one way to address American history?
I guess in one sense, you can say it is one way to address American history. But I would say that it's a wrong way to look at American history. And especially with them, I mean, like, with critical race theorists, there's a lot of, like, in the stuff that they say, their ideology is always behind that. So you're dealing with people who deny objective truth. They don't actually believe that there is such thing as the truth. So they would never say that there's an accurate view of history. There's only different ways of viewing history. So if I said something like if I give like a historical fact to them, it wouldn't be like, you couldn't make that claim with them. It would just be like, oh, well, that's your perspective. And well, here's my perspective. Or as they say it, we're telling stories. So that's your story. Here's my story. Which I would say, ultimately, if that's the way that they're coming at history, that kind of makes them ill-equipped to study history, because you're not actually going to be getting an accurate view of history.
Right.
You can then just say whatever you want and then say, well, boom, this is history.
So let me jump in and ask this. Mm-hmm. What would you say to those who say about our founding political document, which is the Declaration of Independence, well, it was put together by racist men.
Mm-hmm.
Some had slaves.
I think there's some historical nuance in there, because I know some people, like I believe Thomas Jefferson, and I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure Benjamin Franklin as well, did want to abolish slavery when it came to the document, but didn't, because they figured people would reject it if they got rid of slavery. So there already was this idea of, okay, like, we need to get rid of slavery, kind of among the founders.
Mm-hmm.
But I would also then say is that the document is a really good document. Like, it's, I would say, grounded in like Judeo-Christian values. Mm-hmm. And I think that the issue is not the document itself. It's the country not living up to what its founding document says. I think that's the goal we should strive to, is to live up to what the document says about all men being created equally. And I would say by God's grace, we have been, our country has been moving in that direction.
Yeah, and that is the ideal of the American story, is that we have a creator who endows us with inalienable rights. Mm-hmm. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And if you read further, the purpose of government is to secure the inalienable rights of the citizens.
Yep.
And, you know, those who are proponents of critical race theory are correct in that a number of the founding fathers did hold slaves, but they had this higher ideal that really was incongruent with the idea of holding slaves. Yep. Some had a troubled conscience over it. Jefferson freed his slaves. And there were other founding fathers who freed their slaves as well. I'm thinking of Washington. You know, that was part of their culture. It was wrong to have slavery. It was incompatible with American ideals, and yet they came up with this huge overarching principle where we could form this new nation. And yet there's many today who just want to tear it all down. They say they were corrupt, but isn't that true of all of us? We're all sinful, right? Yeah. We all have some level of corruption. We're all corrupt and sinful. But it was by God's grace that they could put together a political document like the Declaration of Independence, which brings me to a bill that the state legislature passed this last session. It was called the Teaching American Principles Act. And it requires the teaching of America's founding documents, like the Declaration of Independence, like the Constitution, other important speeches throughout American history. And is this one way to address critical race theory, Justin, in our schools?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to address it in our schools, because I think the charge is always, which I think is actually just kind of like unfounded a little bit, where they say like, oh, they're public schools are shying away from American history, and they're not actually teaching the true history of America. I mean, I grew up in the public school system. We learned about slavery. We learned about Jim Crow. We saw movies and like pictures of slaves and everything like that. So I don't know the schools that are actually not teaching that. So a lot of times, like when critical race theorists give that charge, what they're saying is that you're not teaching the history that I have approved of and that I want you to teach. I think one reason that people are buying into their type of history is because these founding documents aren't being taught in our schools. Jonathan Butcher, in his book Splintered, actually talks about this as well, that it needs to be more room for civics where we go over the founding principles of our country. The principles are amazing, and we live in one of the most amazing nations on planet Earth. I guess, like, in short, yes, that I think that's the way to do it, is kind of teaching what the true founding of our country is. And also with the bill that they're not shying away from anything. Like, they're reading like Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington and many other prominent black people who were actually slaves.
No, and that's an important point, that I believe that we do live in the greatest, freest nation on the face of the earth. And the reason why is it can be traced back to our founding documents, the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, which limits government and really puts people in control of the government. We have incredible influence and sway over who will represent us in Congress and who will be our president. We also live in a great melting pot where people from every nation on the face of the earth, every skin color, every ethnicity, every people group is represented here. And we have gotten along remarkably well. It doesn't mean that we haven't had our problems, but in context of or in light of what's happened in other nations, I'm thinking of today as we record this program. It's not going to come out until a few days later, but today is the anniversary of India's independence as a nation. And when that happened, people don't realize that it was their neighbors were killing neighbors. Hindus and Muslims were killing each other, and it was one of the greatest mass migrations in human history, where when Britain gave back India for its self-rule, they created two countries. It was India and Pakistan. Pakistan became a majority Islamic nation. India was a Hindu nation. But in as soon as they were granted independence, there was huge bloodshed and there was a huge migration, and we forget that that was based on religion. But Justin, we've seen throughout history where other cases of whether it's religious violence or ethnic violence, I think of what happened in Rwanda in 1994, where it was close to 1 million, the Hutus and the Tutsis were killing each other. We've seen this time and again. And yet here in this country, we've been able to come together and to meld together as a people.
I think the issue with this ideology is that it teaches as if that's where we are now when it comes to slaves. Like, I mean, like when Biden in his presidential campaign can say that a black person can lose their life just in the course of living their life, which is blatantly false. we're by God's grace, we're not there.
That's right. By the way, Kentucky's attorney general chimed in and had something to say about that when he spoke at the Republican National Convention. Daniel Cameron had some strong words to say. We've got just a couple minutes here. I want to go over, pivot to the church. Is critical race theory influencing the church today?
Yes. There's definitely, so you have prominent theologians, like one, Jamar Tisby, who literally argues that an implication of the gospel is being an anti-racist. He worked with Ibram X. Kendi in his anti-racist institution. You have other, he also openly supports critical race theory. Yeah, and then even says that if you disagree with it, it's because you're racist.
Of course, Ibram X. Kendi is one of the most prominent proponents of CRT, and he says this: the only remedy to racist discrimination is anti-racist discrimination. The only remedy to past discrimination is present discrimination. The only remedy to present discrimination is future discrimination. So his prescription essentially is reverse racism.
Exactly.
It's for black people or people of color to discriminate against white people. I mean,
yeah,
that's racism, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's and what's also interesting is what he deems as racist is anti-racist is literally just whatever he decides it is. So like in his book, he creates the categories and holds you accountable to what he just created.
So what can the church do? I want to go back to the church. Mm-hmm. What can the church do to respond to CRT?
I think the biggest thing is, well, be familiar with it, call it out, and I mean, ultimately, preach Christ. Like, I mean, the answer to racism is not more racism. The answer to racism is Christ. Yeah. Like, that's, I mean, in him, like Ephesians 2, between Jews and Gentiles, he's our peace, and he tears down the wall of hostility.
Yeah.
So if we come to Christ, we're automatically reconciled. There doesn't need to be more reconciliation.
You have been speaking on this issue, haven't you?
Yes, I am.
Are you available to speak to churches on this topic?
I am available anytime. They just get in contact with me, and I would love to speak.
Very good. And you can contact us through the CPC website, commonwealthpolicycenter.org. Thank you all for tuning in. Justin, thank you for joining the program. God bless you, and keep up the good work.